We have several bills to take up, and we're going to take up Senator Olson's Senate File 3708 first. U.S. Secretary of Education is in town, Secretary Spelling, and she's giving an address over at the Judiciary Building, I believe?
Revenue
Building. And so Senator Olson is going to go over there and find out what the Secretary of Education is going to have to say. But before she does that, we have Senate File 3708. Welcome, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 3708 is a bill about teacher licensure by portfolio. We do, I believe, have a pilot program or in place now whereby a certified teacher can add another area of licensure by portfolio. To this point, there has been no charge for the processing of such an application. And one of the things that has been found is that this is fairly costly to do it, and it has become fairly popular. And so this bill is requesting that fees be added that are allowed to be charged for those who pursue this route. Karen Baumer is here from the Board of Teaching, and she can describe this more fully. Too far? Too close? Okay. She will be describing this more fully, and she also has someone with her that has gone through this process who can give you a little more insight on how it works and why it is appreciated.
Welcome. Please give your name for the record.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Karen Baumer with the Minnesota Board of Teaching, and we are grateful to you this morning, to Senator Olson for carrying this bill for us, and to you for having the opportunity to consider it. I want to give you just a short background and an update on what the licensure via portfolio option is. And as you heard, this bill would allow the Board of Teaching to charge a fee for this licensure via portfolio option. Licensure via portfolio is an option that allows an individual to become licensed in a non-traditional manner. The individual can use prior coursework and transcripts. They can use professional development experiences, professional experiences, and other types of things to demonstrate that they have met the same competencies and standards that a teacher would be required to meet in a traditional preparation program. For example, an individual who wishes to become a Spanish teacher, who had served in the Peace Corps in a South American country, could use some of those experiences and the professional work done at that time as a Peace Corps member towards their licensure and have those experiences recognized. You can see here a portfolio is no small task. I've got a couple here as examples. This is a math portfolio. This big one on top is ESL, an ESL portfolio whereby someone has provided all the evidence for every standard that a traditional preparation program would require, that they've met them, but in a different way. The two on the bottom here are actually for a brand new teacher, someone who is new to the profession. They're required to do two portfolios, one for content and one for pedagogy. And this individual, the two on the bottom, happened to be for a dance teacher. So as you can imagine, the portfolio option has become tremendously valuable since we launched it in 2004. It's not for everyone, but we have to date issued 196 licenses in this way over the course of the last several years. It continues to grow in popularity, and our cost projections show that it is simply not sustainable at its current rate of growth unless we have some additional support for it. And a fee would allow this portfolio option to continue to be an important alternative. This bill is supported by Education Minnesota, by the Department of Education, and by our partners in higher education, MACTE. And just to close, I'll give you a little bit of a better sense of the statewide impact. We pulled numbers this week to see the statewide, if this has in fact been used across the state. And in fact, from the 11 regions, every single one of the regions has at least, our smallest number was 2 in Region 5. 5, the North Staples area. But in other regions, it was anywhere from 105 folks here in the metro to 6 in the Northwest Warren and Bemidji area. But really to say that this has been a statewide option used by every region, folks by every region in the state. And I would be happy to provide further information or data if you're interested, but that is the gist of the licensure via portfolio option as it exists today and our request. And we do have one individual with us, Laura Messler from the Edina Public Schools, who actually went through the licensure via portfolio option and is able to speak to her experience.
Okay. Please give your name for the record and go ahead.
Good morning. Laura Messler. And I'm here from Edina Public Schools.
Okay. Ms. Messler, go ahead.
Thank you for listening this morning. I came to Minnesota with 13 years of teaching experience. The lovely state of Minnesota, I love it. I had 10 years of middle school experience and high school experience, and then 3 additional years in an elementary media center. I came to your state with excellent references and reviews, and current licensure in both Texas and Georgia for language arts and also media. I was told I would need numerous classes to acquire licensure in Minnesota for communication arts, named language arts in Texas and Georgia. In Minnesota, the licensure is for grades 5 through 12. My licenses for Texas and Georgia in language arts were grades 6 through 12, so the 5th grade year was the problem. The portfolio option allowed me to get licensed in Minnesota without taking classes that are expensive, time-consuming, nor would they be classes that would have met requirements for lane change in the salary schedule for me. So classes suggested also were not exactly appropriate for a beginning teacher because I did have some experience. So the portfolio option allowed me to add language arts, communication arts in Minnesota to my license was a valuable experience for me. It is a very time-consuming process. It's not something that you quickly get done. However, it was a great option for me and many others coming to the state.
Thank you, Ms. Messler. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum. And then also I'd like to recognize our former member of this committee, former State Senator or State Senator Wes Goldman. So welcome.
Nice to hi.
Welcome. Nice to have you here. I don't know. Somehow he looks younger than he did when he was sitting here. You must be having a pretty good time, huh? Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Olson and Ms. Ballmer. I'm just looking at the bill. The paragraph A says that the application has to be accompanied by a processing fee of $57. Later on in paragraph B, it says that you have to submit $75 fee. And on the back page, it says that you have to pay $500 for the first portfolio and $250 for any subsequently submitted portfolio. Is the $57 or $75, depending on what kind, or is it both? Or I'm a little confused about what the fees are to do this.
Ms. Ballmer.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Senator Hahn, great questions. The $57 application fee is standard to anyone who applies for a license. This would be at the time, this would assume that someone had been approved, that they had submitted a portfolio and it had been approved. So that's the standard application fee, and that would apply to these folks as well who had submitted an a license via portfolio and it had in fact been approved. The fees that you see in paragraph B, there are 3. The $75 eligibility fee we placed in there as what we might think of as a screening tool. We find that there are lots and lots of people who are interested in licensure via portfolio, and it's simply not for everyone. It is for a unique population that can demonstrate through life experience, professional experience, and coursework and so on, that they have met all those standards. And so what we have found is that that there tends to be a lot of work that happens with folks who may not be eligible for the portfolio. It may not be appropriate for them. So we had thought of it as sort of a screening. That may be something that needs to come out. Perhaps the fee itself, the establishment of a fee, would be sufficient to do that work. And so perhaps that does need to come out, and that would be something we'd be certainly open to. The two fees that you see on the back side, there's a $500 fee for the first portfolio submitted, and then as you see, if there was a second portfolio submitted, it would be a fee of $250. The rationale there is that for an existing teacher who's already licensed, they would have to submit one portfolio, a content portfolio, because presumably they had met the pedagogy in their earlier licensure preparation. And so for an existing teacher, they would submit one portfolio at the cost of $500. If someone is brand new to the profession, they have never had a teaching license, they need to submit two, as in the case of these two black binders at the bottom, someone who is brand new to the profession in dance. And so there's a pedagogy portfolio and a content portfolio. We didn't think it was quite right to ask them to pay $500 for both. So that was the rationale there, but we're certainly open to your analysis of what we have proposed.
And Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, I think Ms. Belmer, I'm not sure if she went into that in some depth, but there is a fair amount of work that is required to process these. And I believe you do use some outside consulting relating to the particular field that is with a solid professional background to do some of these reviews, and that just isn't possible without adding it and adding the more substantial fees here. On the question relative to the screening one, one possible option there, if in fact I don't know how many, if there's a lot of people that send out feelers, and want to do something that's fairly superficial and think that they can get it. I don't know if you have that kind of thing. That's what I think it's attempting to be a deterrent. One could also have that fee to serve that role, but if, in fact, your portfolio is approved, have that actually apply to the $500 or the $250 so that it isn't actually on top of that cost. That would be another option versus just the elimination of it. If it is felt that having that fee at least covers going through an exercise for those that may not have be as serious a candidate or have the come close to the credentials that would be required to have an approved portfolio.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Messler, how long do you think it took you to put your portfolio together?
Ms.
Messler?
I kind of kept track just roughly about 150, 160 hours. And I would add to that I'm extremely organized. I've been teaching for a while, and so when we moved up here, I have things in buckets and labeled, and so for me it was very easy to pull that kind of stuff together. Gave me a lot of room for thought, but for someone new or someone who perhaps isn't as organized, they said that the average was 200 hours. Am I correct? That's what they told me for my situation.
Ms. Ballmer, can you do you have an idea as to what the actual costs of processing this would be? I mean, are the fees reflective of the cost? And maybe you can mention how many of these do you process in a year or two?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have our numbers have continued to grow. So an annual number is difficult because it has grown by leaps and bounds every year. But we're up to 196 to date, as of Wednesday. And our first year, there were 40. The next year, it jumped to about 60. And the next year, it jumped again from there. So we continue to grow annually. To your question of what the actual cost is of processing it, we do pay an outside reviewer, someone who has content expertise in the area, mathematics, English as a second language, and so on. And we send that out to a reviewer. We have had estimates done about the number of hours that it requires for a reviewer who's done this before. The first time is always going to take longer. So we assume that this was a reviewer who was fairly proficient, understood the process. For a content area portfolio, we have estimated that it takes about 7 to 10 hours to do a very thorough job of moving through that. For a standards of effective practice, which is the pedagogy piece of it, those are a little more difficult to quantify and to find evidence for. We have found that those take significantly longer. Anywhere between 25 and 30 hours is the estimate that we have been working with if a very solid review is done. Right now, we pay reviewers $100 to do that work. We believe that's not reflective of the work that they do. We have been fortunate to find folks in the field, both teachers and faculty members, who are willing to do that. That's becoming increasingly difficult. One, because of the time commitment that it involves, and secondly, the number of portfolios that we are having submitted. We are needing to train more and more reviewers as more and more portfolios come in so that they're equipped to do that. Hopefully that provides a bit of context about our costs. There certainly is postage. It goes out to the reviewer. They're not a local reviewer, and paying for the postage when it comes back. And we have actually paid for postage to send it back to the candidate. All those little things tend to add up in this whole process.
We don't have a fiscal note as such for this bill, but is it possible that you could kind of put together a sheet that would lay out the what you project as the costs for probably on a portfolio basis, and then because it doesn't matter as to how many you do, I imagine that would be reflective in how many reviewers you need, or but if you could do that, and then it would be helpful to us, because I think the fees, as you were describing it, could be reflective of a screening. You know, like if you raise the price high enough, somebody's going to think twice about doing it. But it also ought to reflect, I think, the actual costs of having these processed that the board has, you know, involved, or what costs the board has invested. And then that would give us an idea of, you know, kind of what, I mean, how, I mean, we don't know exactly how you came up with 500 and then 250. Basis for that.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Maumer talked with me about doing it, she did convince me that they had a kind of a solid rationale, and I think the fact that the teachers' organizations and others are also in agreement, I think they understand that this does have a cost, and it actually, even still with that investment, represents a substantial savings over the alternatives of licensure. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's a formidable one, but I think that it is legitimate to lay out the rationale for arriving at it. And I believe the two, even though she described that the pedagogy takes longer and therefore would cost more, it isn't the issue of which is which. Here, it's rather the fact that if you're doing two of them, that kind of evens out, that one may cost more than the other content one. Now, I don't know what proportion. It might be interesting how many of the ones that have been done, or what portion of them have been ones that require the two portfolio versus are more of them tending to add a content field.
Well, Senator Olson, the rationale I was using is that generally in government we try to connect the cost of the fee fairly close to the cost of the service received, and I mean you can obviously include, when you go through a budgeting type process, you can include all your costs. I mean, it's time that the board puts into it, the cost of the reviewers, that's kind of how you should approach it in terms of setting the cost of fees. We generally aren't in the process of setting, making money off of fees. But, you know, I think it's been thought of as a way of making money in the last few years. But
Mr. Chairman, this one, I think it clearly is not to make money. I think it's trying to continue to, with the limited resources, to be able to continue to provide the service, because it is getting too costly to do that for the service that's being rendered. Mm-hmm. So I think it's very legitimate to be, you know, be asking for the fee. Were you suggesting, for example, in the two portfolio, that if in fact one of those, the pedagogy, is more expensive, that the costs be attributed to that one, and maybe more delineate that? That if it's a content area one, that would be the X dollars, and if it's includes also one that's for pedagogy, based on the fact, the testimony that we've heard, that should be higher? Is that kind of what you're suggesting?
I'm not suggesting that we iron out exactly how you charge the fee, but I think you ought to have a rationale for why you chose 500 and 250. I mean, one could cost more than another, but maybe you adjust it because of most people have two instead of one. But I think there ought to be some fairly close connection between the fees that are charged for the service received. And because it doesn't have to be perfect, but we don't, you know, judging from the legislation, we don't really know. I mean, you could be funding your agency off of this. I mean, in fact, you probably are supplementing, paying for this right now through your agency's appropriation. And obviously, that's not what you want to do. You want to be able to have this self-sustaining through the fees, and you know, your agency's appropriation, you know, goes for something else. Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One other fee question, I guess, Senator Olson. If you do a subsequent or a second portfolio, is the $75 and the $57 also charged for that second portfolio?
Mr. Chair, I think this Mr. Chair and Senator Scogin, I believe this is applying to a situation where two portfolios are required because of the nature of the application. I think if they were coming back for another content area, that would require another $500 fee. Am I correct in that assumption? As she pointed out, in that one particular candidate's application, they were required for dance to have both the pedagogy and the content area in order to achieve or add that licensure. So in that case, both of them were required. And that's what I believe how this what this wording is meant to do. Or are you, well, submitted subsequently. So are you, maybe I'm misleading here. I'm sorry. Ms. Maurer maybe needs to answer that, and I shouldn't have jumped in.
Okay, Ms. Maurer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scogin, Senator Olson, you're right that the intent, we were thinking about folks who would need to submit two portfolios at the same time for one application. However, we could also interpret that for a content area teacher who wanted to do one portfolio in one licensure area and subsequently add another field in another area, and that $250 could apply to that second portfolio for the existing teacher as well. So any subsequent or second, but you're right that it was particularly designed for someone who has to, by definition, submit two portfolios.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Olson, I think Ms. Ballmer can bring us back some information on you know what we had just discussed, and that would be helpful. It seems like the fee concept is what would work here, because of the fluctuating numbers that you have in terms of using the portfolios. And it's just that if you can lay out for us a little better justification for the cost of the fees, that would be helpful.
Mr. Chairman, if it's appropriate, can this be laid over for possible
sure.
inclusion in the bill? And I will certainly work with Ms. Baumer to get that information and so that it's satisfactory in our understanding of how it's to be used.
Yeah. Yes, it can, because I think it just relates to the fee end of it. The other one was, and you mentioned that the $75 seems to be, there was not much discussion about that as a the purpose of that $75, other than it might dissuade some people who want to use it or use that process. It didn't seem like it was tied to any other activity. Is that or part of that, Ms. Baumer?
Mr. Chair, you're right. It is in large part of a mechanism for folks to really help them take a close look at what the licensure via portfolio option is. When we the eligibility review internally consists of a transcript review in general. Sometimes additional information is needed once those transcripts are received, course descriptions and so on, to see if the person, we generally want to make sure that they've got the equivalent of a major in the field or a related field, to make sure that they've got some substance of content knowledge prior to entering this process. So it really is an internal mechanism. The review is done internally. We could, again, look at different ways to either absorb that into the full cost or perhaps the establishment of a fee in general would be sufficient to accomplish that purpose. We would still do the eligibility review. That will remain a part of our process because we believe that's important before someone goes to all this work. We need to make sure that they're a viable candidate. So we will continue to do that work regardless.
Well, it seems like the $75, it would be good if you could absorb it. You have the $57, which is like an application fee, and I assume that that you're doing something for the $57, which is really checking, you know, is this person really have some connection to getting a licensure through the board, right?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that is the standard application fee, and that is includes the background when they fill out the code of conduct or review statement, and that's the full application for licensure. In this case, once a portfolio would have been approved, for a traditional candidate, it would be once we receive verification from a college or university that they had, in fact, completed a course of study and met all the requirements there. So that's a standard application fee, and that is processed. The license is then issued through educator licensing at the Department of Education. If I could also note that at the end of the language, you'll see one small sentence that we recognize that we may have to waive or reduce fees based on financial need. We certainly don't want cost to become the sole deterrent. We want to make sure that the right people have access to this option, and we believe it is valuable. It's not for everyone, but there is a select group of people that it is a good option for, but we don't want cost to stand in the way of someone becoming licensed if, in fact, it is appropriate for them.
Okay. All right. I think try to work that $75 into the overall cost. That'd be a little cleaner. All right. Senator Olson?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would, if there are no further questions, then I would move that we lay Senate File 3708 over for consideration in the omnibus bill.
All right. Senator Olson moves Senate File 3708. And members, what we'll do is we'll get the information from Ms. Baumer, and then we'll have staff reconstruct the change or make the adjustments needed in the language. So So on Senator Olson's motion, any questions or anyone else that wants to testify on this? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Oppose the same sign. Motion is adopted.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Thank Chair, you. Members.
Okay. Senator Senjum. Senator Sparks, too. I believe both have... Welcome, and we have Senate File 2506. Members, we do have a fiscal note on this in your packet, so we'll have Senator Senjum go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's a delight to be here this morning and talk about an avenue of school funding that's certainly important to a lot of districts in rural Minnesota, and we hope today to make sure that that funding is insured on into the future. It's about the wind power production tax, Mr. Chair and members, and the fact that as renewable energy expands across Minnesota, wherever it might be, we have some opportunities here, and especially in greater Minnesota, where we have certainly schools with declining enrollments and a lot of other needs. We have an opportunity to make sure that those schools can stay strong and healthy. And I'm not talking about certainly large amounts of money, but some money that it would frankly be appropriate to go to them, given their proximity to these, in most cases, windmills, and the importance of this funding to individual school districts. Last year, as you may or may not recall, within the legislation, there was a notation made where if a district had wind power production tax money coming to them, that equal amount of money, as I understand it, was taken away from their state aid. We'd like to, through this bill, make sure that money is restored. And in many cases, and you'll hear from Superintendent Joe Brown of Grand Meadow momentarily, that money is not substantial at all. It may grow certainly larger as time goes on, but we're talking, frankly, at this point of a few thousand dollars. But it is important to many of our rural school districts, and we're delighted to be here and to introduce this idea to you. And I want to let Senator Sparks make some comments as well prior to Superintendent Brown's testimony.
Okay, thank you, Senator Senjum. Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's nice to be back in front of your committee. And we do have two similar bills. Mine was Senate File 2748, and we know that you guys have a very busy schedule, and so to try to be considerate of your time, we're going to present these two bills together. Senator Senjum said this is a very important bill in not even southern Minnesota, but I believe around the entire state. And Superintendent Brown will give you some more details of what's happened and what we hope we can do during this legislative session. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would be glad to turn over to Superintendent Brown from Grand Meadow School District.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Sparks. Superintendent Brown?
Hi, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Joseph Brown, Superintendent at Grand Meadow. I'm pleased to be joined by my senator, Senator Sparks, and the grandparent of one of my first grade students at Grand Meadow, Senator Senjum. I'm pleased to be able to speak in support of Senate File 2508 and the companion Senate File 2748 by Sparks. The effect of this bill is simply to restore the revenue that was earned through the windmill energy production tax to local rural public schools that was generated through Chapter 279.029 of the Minnesota statutes. The Chapter 279.029 was originally passed in 2002 and amended in 2005. And in lieu of paying property taxes or being factored into the tax capacity of a local school district, windmills are assessed a windmill energy production tax at a very low rate of 0.12 cents per kilowatt hour of electricity produced. The revenues that are collected from this tax are distributed the following ways. 80% go back to the counties that the wind turbines are located, 14% to the cities and counties, and 6% to school districts. It's estimated in your fiscal note that $123,000 last year was distributed to local public schools. Grand Meadow received less than $4,000. This year, however, we're expected to receive $25,000, and next year we are expected to receive $50,000 because of the growth of the windmills in our area. The Section 12 of House File 2245, which was the Omnibus Education Act, passed in the last few nights of the legislative session. This small amendment was placed in the bill, and what this in essence does, it takes away the money from the local school districts that was promised to our local farmers. As I mentioned, in 2007, Grand Meadow received $3,725 in wind energy production tax, and we're expected to receive $25,000 in just a few weeks from this year, from last year's production. Next year, we're expected to receive $50,000. I just want to show you the essence of what is going on in our region. In 2007, in the last few months, the Prairie Star Wind Farm implemented 61 additional windmills in the Grand Meadow and Southland School District. This was a $180 million project. Tremendous economic development for our state. But because of the way the tax law was written years ago, these folks do not pay any property taxes, nor do they add to the property value or tax capacity of our school district. Xcel Energy is in the process. If you drive on Interstate 90 and go by the windmill restaurant, you'll see another 50 wind turbines laying on the ground. Now, they'll start installing another 50 wind turbines in our school district starting April 1st of 2008. As I mentioned, each of these wind turbines are valued at $2 million, and they do take valuable farmland out of production through the installation of service roads to each of these wind turbines and, of course, the footprint that the wind turbines sit on. This is a key distinction between the way that we treat power lines here in Minnesota and the way we treat wind turbines. Power companies pay property taxes on the power lines. The wind turbine folks do not. You know, we're a small school district. We are actually one of the few school districts in Minnesota that are growing. We have 370 students. We're located 25 miles south and west of Rochester. We are a very energy efficient school. We're the Dome School. We implemented all-day everyday kindergarten last year, and we're one of the first schools in the state to require 4 years of math and 4 years of science. And the reason why we did that is because of our proximity to the Mayo Clinic and to the Hormel Institute. Our students need to leave our school district with 4 years of math and 4 years of science. And as a superintendent, we made a decision 2 years ago, our school board did, to increase our graduation requirements, and we were going to use this $50,000 that we are expected to receive next year to pay for one additional high school math and science teacher. And we were kind of flabbergasted when it was put into the bill the last couple hours of the session last year without a hearing, and that's what we're most upset about. Our resident farmers are very upset right now in Grand Meadow because they were promised that if they signed these 20-year leases that they would generate some additional revenue for their local public schools. And as I mentioned, our school board did make the decision 2 years ago to require the graduating class of 2010 to complete 4 years of math and 4 years of science. Now, there's another area I want to bring to the committee's attention. As a rural region, we are thrilled to be able to contribute to the renewable portfolio standard of 25% by 2025. But the change in the distribution of the wind energy production tax revenue to local public schools has made it more difficult for wind developers to obtain approval to develop additional wind farms in Minnesota. You know, so the amount of money that the state could collect, $124,000, is peanuts compared to the millions of dollars we're losing in economic development. We have a local windmill company called Horizon Wind Energy that installed the 61 windmills in our region. Because of this bill passing last year, it stopped wind production development in southern Minnesota. And they went across the state in Iowa, and they are now installing 300 windmills at the cost of $600 million, 14 miles south of my school district. They just went right across the border because of the way that they were treated there versus the way that perception-wise they're being treated here. By the way, the first congressional district in Minnesota is the fifth windiest congressional district in the country. I know there has to be a joke in that someplace, but it has nothing to do with me, I hope. As a rural region, we also understand that windmills are very important to Minnesota. There is a local cost, however, that is associated with the installation of wind farms. Wind farms do create a flickering effect or a strobing effect on our farmers and livestock. Wind turbines do make a swooshing sound when in operation. Our local volunteer fire department had to obtain special equipment to provide special emergency support for workers servicing these wind turbines, which are located 240 feet in the air. And these wind turbines have taken, and truly, you know, the top quality farmland out of production. The implementation of additional wind farms is a win-win for the state of Minnesota. The additional $50,000 that would be generated in January of 2009 with the installation of 87 wind turbines would add an additional 80 cents per day for a Grand Meadow student. Without this additional revenue, we will not be able to fund the additional math and science teachers to fulfill the need to teach additional classes in math and science. And finally, I've learned as a small school superintendent that I must plan at least 2 years in advance. We made graduation requirements, personnel, and policy decisions based on what the current law was last year. We had little to no notice that a change was being proposed in the distribution of the wind energy production tax in the last few days of the legislative session. Therefore, I humbly request that the wind energy production tax be restored to the rural school districts across the state and assign a partnership as we work together to meet the renewable portfolio standard and provide the funding for a quality educational experience for our rural schools. And the last comment I'll make, Senator, is that this affects 21 school districts, and most of them are located in the southern part of the state, which is where we have most of the wind. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Superintendent. Let me just ask some questions here. I originally kind of thought that it had to do with the, you know, school district owning a windmill and actually having, but the production, this is the wind energy production taxes. So this would be similar to some of the other utilities, I think, that are taxed. Does let's say a farmer allows a windmill to be put up on his land, and I assume that they have a payment of some sort, either up front in a lump sum or over a period of years. Does that, and I'm not sure if we have a wind expert here or not, but does that increase the value of that farmer's land, or is that, does it decrease it if there is a windmill generating power?
Mr. Chairman, if I may, if I had some of my local farmers here with me, I think they could argue both, and only because of this. There, for example, my school board chairman owns 6,500 acres of corn and soybean land in Maurer County, and he decided not to put any windmills up. And the reason for that is when he and his brother farm the land, they don't want to be farming around these access roads, which do cut right through the heart of Maurer County. And so it takes it's a 60-foot-wide hard-base gravel road that goes right through the middle of these farm fields. And farmers, you know, they do get paid a compensation to have a wind turbine on their property. However, some of our farmers have said, we're not going to put up with the noise, the flickering, strobing effect, and the fact that we have to farm around the land. You know, when these folks put their big John Deere's down, they don't want to bring them back up to move a corner. So they would argue it both ways.
There should be some actual facts, though. I mean, if you went to the assessor's office and you had one farm that had a windmill on it and one farm right next to it that does not have a windmill on it, and the land is basically, you know, the same agricultural land, what would be the difference in valuation?
Mr. Chairman, we've not seen any difference at this point. Now, again, these windmills were installed last August, and as you know, property taxes sometimes take a year or two to catch up in assessment and valuation, but we have not actually seen that. And but we do know this, that the, you know, I give the example in my testimony that if we had 87 homes in our district valued at $2 million apiece, obviously our tax capacity would increase, and it would make it easier for a small rural district to increase our operating levy. We are a district which is just coming out of statutory operating debt. We have a special election in 2 weeks on April the 8th to increase our operating levy. And it would be much easier if I could take that $180 million of production, $180 million of investment, if that was a business or a corporation, industry, my tax capacity would increase, my property taxes would go down for everybody, and it would make it much easier for our local residents to vote for an increase in the operating levy. So I think when the law was passed originally in 2000, actually the original law back in wind power goes back to 1992, but the 2002 and 2005 legislation did a trade-off, no property taxes for windmills in lieu of the windmill energy production tax. The other thing I'll point out is that the counties and the townships and the cities are still collecting this money. The only difference to the change of the law last year was that they took the money away from the public schools. Our county, cities, and townships still obtain the revenue.
I was just last Friday, I was visiting with my brother and sister who live up in Monticello, Minnesota, and they were talking about when the nuclear power plant went into Monticello. It was not in the city. It was actually in the Monticello Township, which is outside of the city. Mm-hmm. And the township received so much additional tax revenue at that time that they tarred all the roads in the township, and it was a windfall. They didn't know how to spend the money. The tax money, it was coming in so fast. So Monticello annexed the power plant up there, and then it was shortly after that when the legislature said, well, I mean, one school district can't have a windfall like that, so we basically, I think that was when the laws were said that the revenues coming in have to be shared, in a sense. And I wonder, is Mr. Melcher, if you can give us some history. I think that provision that was in the that's in the both of your bills, Senator Sparks and Senator Senjum, was actually a governor's proposal last year.
I have it.
Can you give us some history of what's going on here?
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. Including the wind energy tax, the school district share of the wind energy tax receipts in the county apportionment subtraction for general education aid was a governor's budget recommendation this past legislative session. It wasn't something that came in right at the end of the legislative session. It was presented as part of the governor's budget bill and was heard before the committees during the session. I think one thing we found out is that this is a growing area. There are more districts that are affected each year. I think Grand Meadow wasn't actually even on our list as a 2006 recipient of any wind energy revenues. They've been added to the list in 2007, and on the fiscal note, you can see they're getting about $3,700 in 2007, and they're projecting a large increase in the next year. I think from the department's perspective, it was felt that this was similar to some other miscellaneous revenues that school districts receive from the county that are over and above the general education funding that all school districts receive, and that the amount of revenue per student that school districts receive should be dependent on the number of students they have and the needs of the students. In other words, if they have special education students, they need more money for those. If they have students in poverty and so forth, and that the fact that there was a windmill in the district, in the view of the administration, didn't seem to be something that caused an extra burden on the school district in terms of having to raise additional revenue in order to provide additional programs related to needs of students. So I think that was part of the rationale. And, you know, we recognize that unfortunately there were some districts that were planning on accessing that revenue that had made plans, and this creates a difficult situation for them.
What are some of those other revenues?
Chairman, there's a list of some of them in the fiscal note, okay. Including power line taxes, liquor licenses and fees, delinquencies on real estate taxes that come in late. There are a variety of other kinds of miscellaneous revenues that school districts receive that are subtracted off, and there may be some that are not subtracted off as well. So, but the general philosophy of the state for many years, going back to the Minnesota Miracle, was that we're determining the amount of revenue each school district gets based on the needs of the students and not based on whether you happened to have a power line running through the district, or you had a lot of delinquencies on taxes that you were able to collect, that it should be based on the needs of the students.
Senator Wergen, you had a question.
I do, Mr. Chair, and I have no idea. I may have to ask if I'm correct or not. I think there is a significant difference between this, for instance, and transmission lines or pipelines, and that's that when transmission lines or pipelines go in, that land is actually condemned, and there pays a personal property tax. In the case of the wind generation, I believe that is an easement through the farmland and generates rent for the property owner, and that land actually stays on the tax rolls. So that's the difference between the two scenarios, and it's pretty significant. There's still property tax on the land underneath the wind farms. There's no property tax paid by a landowner on the condemned land that's used for gas pipelines or transmission lines.
Superintendent?
Senator, members of the committee, that's a good point the senator is making. I would add one more caveat, though. No place in Minnesota economic development do we have this set up where $180 million of a plant comes into a location and they are tax-free. That was the trade-off in the 2002 legislation. Invest in Minnesota, put these multi-million-dollar wind turbines in the rural regions, and the trade-off is you pay no property taxes on that huge investment. I'd love to have $180 million of a cement plant in my district right now, seriously, because that would add to my tax capacity and it would make it much easier for me. It is so difficult for the rural areas. You know, the 99 of us school districts last November that had to go out and ask the voters to increase their local property taxes, which, as you know, is not the most popular thing to do as a local politician, which I am. It's hard to go out and ask people to increase their property taxes. But, you know, no place would we have given this many multi-millions of dollars of totally tax avoidance. But the trade-off is you pay a little bit of wind energy production tax. And, by the way, we're going to give 6% of that to the schools. And I guess the thing that bothers me the most, again, is the timing. And I understand the legislative process, but, you know, you have to be a little bit empathetic with a rural superintendent. We have to make these decisions years in advance of who we're going to hire in our school. I have no money. My $50,000 was pulled out on the last night of the session. I have no money to pay this new math and science teacher that my kids in my local community expect to have us bring on board next month. Unless the legislature wants to throw another $50,000 our way, we'd be glad to take it. But we planned for that because we read the current law. And then the last night of the session when the omnibus bill was passed, all of a sudden it's gone. I mean, how do I plan?
Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Superintendent, I wasn't meaning that you shouldn't get this. I just wanted to compare apples to apples. And I just wanted to...
I totally agree with you then. Okay.
I also represent 12 rural school districts, so I get the picture of rural school districts really well. But
I apologize.
Mr. Chair, the only thing I think we have to be careful to do is make sure that all of Minnesota kids are treated fairly. And if we find a way to help some of them, we have to be sure that we're being fair to all of them. There simply are some places in the state where you absolutely can't put up a wind turbine, so it doesn't work. While I understand what these folks are doing totally, we need to be cautious what we do for one district and then another. And believe me, apples to apples doesn't exist for most part of the education world. So,
Senator Wergen, I think that's correct, and I think that was the message that Mr. Melcher was presenting us too. The question that I would like to ask of the tax committee, I guess, would be: are we treating, or are the tax laws different for, you know, the power lines or the generating plants or the than they are for the wind generators. I mean, I could see, is it Pipestone that has all those windmills? Senator Senjum?
Mr. Chair and members, my understanding, and I forget the name of the company, is they make, my understanding is they make the big blades out there. I don't think they make the turbines, but they make the blades, I believe.
But there's a there's an area out there that has all kinds of wind, Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman, in the fiscal note, we identify the school districts that have the largest amount. They're mostly on Buffalo Ridge, and you see Russell, okay. Tyler, Ruthton, Benton are the two districts that have the largest, along with some few others, especially in southwestern Minnesota. But then there are also a lot of movement in South Central as well.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair and members, Senator, maybe Senator, to point out so we don't forget it, this little issue today is not necessarily about Grand Meadow. As we have gotten into the renewable energy standard, depending on the size of the turbines, we're going to see 4,000 to 5,000 new windmills across Minnesota someplace. And so this is not an issue or a matter that's certainly isolated to Grand Meadow. It's one, I think, that provides an opportunity to help a lot of districts across, if you will, the Great Plains. And in some cases, yes, it is southern Minnesota, but these are going to be wherever the wind is. And I think, generally speaking, that's a lot of area in Minnesota.
Senator Wergen and then Senator Cope.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we don't have to get into tax policy, but indeed, coal and nuclear energy are treated very, very different under tax policy than wind energy. There's probably hardly any resemblance to each other, which is, I think, kind of bad because you distort the cost of what it takes to produce wind energy versus what it takes to produce nuclear coal or coal-related energy, because in the other energy areas, they pay not only property tax, but they pay personal property tax, which means on their generation equipment, they pay substantial amounts of money. And that does, admittedly, that does help the school districts that have a nuclear or coal-generating plant in their school district. But they are treated entirely different under our tax codes.
Okay. Senator Coates.
Well, no, Mr. Chair, that's just what I was going
to... Okay. Okay.
I did have one other.
Mr. Melcher, is there... has the department thought any more about the whole issue? Right now, it would go into the basically back into the general fund. Is that correct,
Mr. Chairman? Under the current law, which was the change that was enacted last year, this is a subtraction to the general education aid, which then lowers the state's appropriation need for general education and basically saves the state some dollars in the state general fund.
Okay.
Right.
Senator Cole.
I'm sorry. Mr. Brown, I just had one other question. You had said that there was a big project that moved south, 14 miles south, over the Iowa border because of how they were perceived to be treated. Are you saying because of this change in the law that we did, you're crediting that? And I'm wondering why the wind... the windmill people would be concerned about that. I understand why the farmers are concerned. They kind of were feeling that they were going to benefit their school districts, but why the wind producers themselves would move it.
Mr. Chairman,
Superintendent.
If I could answer the Senator's question, a great question. In meeting with the Horizon Wind Power folks that currently have an office in Grand Meadow, and they told me that when they were getting ready, well, this bill, when it came out in May, it did receive a lot of press in the region. The Rochester Post Bulletin carried multiple stories. Austin Herald, the regional papers made it a big issue, and it is a big issue to us. Because of that, when they went out to try to sell additional wind farms in southern Minnesota, it just stopped because people were going, well, and they were blaming the wind power companies for not paying their taxes. And I made it very clear that, no, the wind folks are paying their taxes. They're paying the full wind energy production tax. It's going to the state. It's simply that they are subtracting that, amount of money from our state aid. And so, you know, don't blame the windmill companies because of the legislation that was passed. That's not their fault. They're paying their tax. But the development of additional wind farms in Minnesota, and Farm Bureau, I know, has a Farm Bureau has come out in favor of the restoration of this tax. That's in their state resolutions this year. In the rural community, and again, this is, this, you know, when you go out and it's not an easy sell to tell somebody they're going to put a football-sized windmill on their property and cut right through their farmland. And so because of that, it's hard to market these wind farms. And they found it just stopped. And so that's why $600 million of economic development went right across the border. And these windmills, they can almost be seen just a few miles from Grand Meadow because they're being put up right on the Iowa border. And if that doesn't burn me as a Minnesotan, it does. Because I want all the economic development to come to Minnesota first. And so, you know, once again, Dr. Melcher and I have a lot of respect for Tom. You know, he's right. You know, the fiscal note right now is $124,000. And I would contend that the amount of revenue that Minnesota has lost is in the millions compared to the $124,000 they're going to take away from the rural schools next year. So I would hope that we would view this, if for no other reason, to get the wind energy production companies back into Minnesota, installing more windmills on our side of Interstate 90.
Thank you.
Well, I guess the issue is, I think, how do we treat individual fund individual schools and programs? I mean, I have to laugh a little bit about the Monticello example. If an individual school district, and Senator Wergen, you're familiar with that area up there, if an individual school district by chance has, you know, 1,000 of these windmills in it, and there was no revenue sharing that went on, that individual school district could have significantly higher revenues per pupil. And the neighboring district might look at that district and say, well, is that fair? Are you being fair in terms of funding our students? So it's a question that creates some perplexing issues. Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And because of this scenario, at one point in time, the Becker School District literally received no state aid. They were basically a self-sufficient school district because of the income from the power plant. So there was a subtraction from their state aid, and there still is. It's just that that's gone down because the area has grown differently. So they actually paid the state at one point in time instead of getting money from the state because of having the power plant.
Mm-hmm. Superintendent?
Senator, thank you. One more little point. Your point of equity does touch a nerve with me, and that goes back to this point about tax capacity. It truly is much easier for some school districts in the state to increase their operating levy than others, and it all is based on your local tax capacity. You know, I represent a county that has no lake. We're the only county, I think, in Minnesota that doesn't have any lake, Maurer County. We're basically an agrarian, rural, small town. I represent Grand Meadow, which is the second largest town in Maurer County, and we have 980 people. Okay? We don't have the tax capacity of Wayzata or Eden Prairie or anybody else. Therefore, it is significantly more difficult for us to raise our operating levy. It's really tough to do that. And so, once again, you know, maybe the other option would be to have the legislature look at putting a property tax on the windmill. I'd love to have that tax capacity because then I could increase my operating levy much faster. But again, for economic development, I think the legislature made a good decision to tell these wind power companies, we're not going to charge you on your physical plant and equipment. We're only going to charge you on the energy that you actually generate. And so that's the major difference. I'd love to have the tax capacity of Wayzata because it would be so much simpler to raise my operating levy.
I think we've heard that more than once in this committee. Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Superintendent. The woes are not over if you get a property tax. Believe me, Sherburne County will tell you that the state giveth and the state taketh away when it comes to revenues off from power plants.
All right, members, kind of a perplexing issue. What I think we could do would be to lay it on the table, and I know I, for one, would like to visit with Mr. Paulson from the tax, fiscal analyst, and from the tax committee, and then try to get a better grasp of how, you know, the impacts of how we treat different utilities and stuff. Yeah, I think as Mr. Melcher mentioned, it was the governor's recommendation last year, and I think it actually came through both the House and the Senate. But, all right, do we have a motion? Senator Salzman. Okay, Senator Salzman moves that. I don't think there was any amendments. Very straightforward. Moves that Senate File 2506 be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus education bill. On that motion, anyone else that wants to testify on this? Ms. Schwab.
Chairman and members, I'm Grace Schwab with the Minnesota School Boards Association, and I hate to interrupt. I know you've had a lengthy debate on this. This was brought by our member school districts in front of us for our delegate assembly and was hotly debated and I think lost by 3 or 4 votes. They feel a little bit like you guys do sitting here today. But I want you to consider the tax bill that we just passed in there. We recognize what happened in Manoman School District by having an Indian reservation basically take over a large portion of that school district. They lost a significant part of their property tax base. And I consider that as windmills grow in this area, you could also see a large loss of property tax base due to nothing the school districts did, but wherein chance these wind farms are taking property tax off the roll.
Okay.
So just a consideration, members.
All right. Thank you, Senator Schwab. All right. On Senator Salzman's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion prevails. So thank you, Senator Sengem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Senator Carlson, welcome. We have Senate File 2409. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. This is Senate File 2409, and what it is it provides a method for some cash flow for intermediate school districts. There are 3 intermediate school districts in the metropolitan area: the 287, which is in the West Metro, 916, the East Metro, and 917, which is in the South Metro. The individual school districts from each region choose to be members of the intermediate school districts, and the intermediates provide quality programs and services in special education, career and technical education, and a variety of other specialty areas for the member districts. The reimbursement for these services comes in the form of membership or tuition payments, and they follow the performance of the services. Senate File 2409 allows the intermediate school districts to access cash flow borrowing in the same manner as regular school districts. This is important for the school districts because of the delay in payments. 3 intermediates, as special school districts, experience similar cash flow problems but do not qualify for cash flow borrowing, as most of their revenue comes in the form of these tuition payments or membership payments. the anticipation, the payments do come. The anticipation comes from state aids for schools, federal aids for schools, or the membership fees and tuition payment. I have an A1 amendment here that I would like to have moved so that we can get it corrected.
Senator Wiegar moves the A1 amendment to Senate File 2409. Be handed out. And then also, members, there is a fiscal note on this bill and in your packets as well. Would you like to go through the amendment, Senator Carlson?
The amendment is primarily to add a full faith and credit connection to the intermediates so that in case of a default, which there has never been one, that the membership, the member districts can levy for a default. And this has been worked out with the with Mr. Melcher, I believe it is, and with the department. And as you can see by the fiscal note, there is, with this amendment and with the method of payment, there is no cost to the state. No cost to the state anticipated.
Senator Carlson, the structure of the intermediate district is such that only the member districts can authorize the levy, I believe.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
So how could you guarantee? I'm just thinking from kind of a financial perspective. How could an intermediate district guarantee full faith and credit when they don't have the authority to effectuate that?
Okay, I can probably give you a wing answer, but what I'll do is I'm going to have my testifier answer that, and that's Ms. Christine Carr, the Director of Administrative Services from the District 916.
All right. Welcome, Ms. Carr.
I think to answer your question, the process for this cash flow borrowing would be that no cash flow borrowing could occur unless each individual member school district passed a resolution at their school board meeting authorizing that the cash flow borrowing could happen. And then if there ever were an instance where they had to levy to cover the cash flow borrowing, it would be levied against the net tax capacity of each individual member school district.
Does I'm not sure what the question I want to ask is. Is a resolution, is that a financial instrument that lenders would accept, I guess? Dr. Melcher, maybe, or somebody? Mr. Deans?
Mr. Chair, my name is Tom Deans. I'm local counsel of the School Board Association, and the intermediate districts are members of the School Board Association. If you had, the way this would work is each of the member districts, a couple of these have around 10, one I think has 13. Each of those member districts would have to pass a resolution prior to the intermediate district doing the borrowing that said that if there was a default, they pledge their full faith and credit to repay this. That's actually, there's a couple of other circumstances where in statute where you've set that up in other circumstances where those underlying districts pledge their levy authority in the event that, in this case, it would be in the event of a default. In other cases, you allow them to pledge that levy authority to actually make the payments.
Okay.
And that would be these would be sold as revenue anticipation certificates. I believe that the banks and the institutions that buy those certificates, if those resolutions were in place, they would believe that those were binding.
I suppose they wouldn't, the lenders would, if they didn't feel that it was sound enough, they wouldn't lend you the money.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. They wouldn't buy the certificates.
So,
but that okay. pledge is there, and they're going to get paid one way or the other. So, and these are general obligations, so they're going to get paid. And it was just a question. See, we used to be able to do these. In the old days, the intermediates used to be able to do these themselves. You didn't have to worry about this because they had the levy authority. And you basically took that levy authority away. What this does is it pushes it down to the member districts, and if there was ever a default, each of those member districts would pay its pro rata share based on its valuation to the total valuation.
Isn't part of the problem that you're dealing with, rather than dealing with one district and getting, let's say, a resolution from one district, you're actually dealing with multiple districts. And that's where there's been, I mean, it's like trying to get the legislature to all agree on one issue, you know, and that's where the difficulty arises, is that you have maybe three-quarters of the districts agreeing, but there's always somebody that's not quite, in tune with the thinking of the...
Mr. Chairman, you're exactly correct there, and that's why you have this protection here. Each of those member districts has to pass this resolution before they can go forward. If they're not all on board, this doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm. The levy authority, wasn't it when Minsky kind of broke away or became a separate entity and from the intermediate districts that levy authority was taken away?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'd rather not go too far into the history on this. It was a belief of a former chair of this committee that they shouldn't have that levy authority. And so he basically imposed his will and took the levy authority away.
All right. Are there restrictions on the... So it would be 100% of the participating districts have to pass the resolutions.
Correct.
Or the resolution.
Mr. Chair, if I might add on
Senator Carlson.
Line 214 of the, I'm sorry, I have a, I might have a different copy of the bill, but it would be in the addition of Section 3, subsection 3B. It says the board may amend its bylaws upon receipt of a written resolution by each of its member school districts. So it does mandate a written resolution by each member.
Okay. Does the department have why don't we take action on the amendment first, and then see, Senator Wieger, I believe, moved the amendment, the A1 amendment. Any other comments on the amendment or discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman and members, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. The department worked with the intermediate districts in crafting this. We support the bill. We think that it works. Also, this bill will correct a technical error that was made in a previous session where the aid portion of this adjustment was inadvertently repealed, and that comes back in for all school districts as well as intermediates, which we think is an important part of the program. So if a district should default, and we never have had a district actually default, the first step is that we make a state aid reduction to offset what the state had to pay to cover the hole in the district's bond payments. And then there's kind of a levy impact as a kind of a second resort in the event that we're not able to do this with aid. So we think that's important to have for all school districts as part of the overall program. It's a technical correction to offset an error that was made in 2003. So we think that this works, and the department supports the legislation.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Any other questions that members have? We have anyone else to testify?
Mr. Chair, I do have my testifier here.
Okay.
I would just like to add a couple of things. Thank you first for hearing this legislation. And the other thing that I'd like to point out is the thing that's different now than in previous years is in 2005 legislation was changed to create the special education tuition billing system, and over 50% of our revenues are generated through special education services. Those are the majority of the students that we serve in an intermediate district. And due to that, we're now experiencing lags in timing of payment for services versus performing for services, just like all public schools do. We were never subject to the shift in payment. We were able to bill and receive ahead of time. We would pre-bill people and we would bill at 100%. Now we're on the same state aid payment timing situation that other districts are, and we're also subject to the 10% shift. So that's really the driving force behind us coming and requesting this legislation.
Is that whole process working okay for the intermediates? Because I believe last year you requested a waiver.
Well, our intermediate district 916 did go forward this school year, and we are on the state special education tuition billing system. The other two intermediates did request a waiver for one more year. So we're working with the department very diligently to make the system work, and they're being very good partners and helping us get that done.
That'll probably, all of you will probably be on that same system.
Shortly. Right. It's scheduled for FY09 that all three will be on the system.
Senator Wergen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll readily admit that this one's not sinking through the surface very well. I have a couple questions. How, if you're borrowing and you're borrowing from budget cycle to budget cycle, how can you accurately predict what the state payments are going to be? Doesn't that create a problem then if you borrow more than what the state payment ends up being if you borrowed in one budget cycle and goes into another one?
Who wants to address that? Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chair, I could try to attempt
to answer.
We would borrow. We anticipate the students that come to our programs, and so we budget based according to the students that will be in each program. And we'll budget just like a regular K-12 would do. We'll look at the payments that would come on the IDEAS payment form. So we'll have to project our cash flow ahead of time.
Okay. Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman and members, on page 2, line 10 of the bill also, I just wanted to point out that the bill would limit the amount of the borrowing to 75% of the projected aids, fees, and tuition payments. And that's similar to what we do currently for aid anticipation borrowing for school districts. So we're not talking about borrowing 100% or anything close to that. And school districts, I think, and intermediate districts, we think can pretty reasonably factor in their budgets within 25%.
Okay. Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That helps a lot. Secondly, if one district defaults, what I'm understanding Mr. Melcher to say is that the payment would still be deducted from their state aids in following years?
Mr. Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman, the way that the bill is written, as far as the intermediates are concerned, there's specific language in here that specifies that the reduction, I think this is on page 4, line 23, that for an intermediate district, the state aid payable to the intermediate district must first be reduced before any reduction to the state aids payable to member districts. So we would be in the event of a default, which we think is highly unlikely, and we have not had any defaults during the program to this point, that we would reduce the state aid payable to the intermediate, and the intermediates do receive a substantial amount of special education aid now under the tuition billing system. That would be the first source that we would go to, and we would only go to the individual member districts in the event that the intermediates were not receiving enough to cover the shortfall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Do you want this laid over, Mr. Chair?
Yes. I think if there's no other questions, I think we're ready for a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 2409 be laid over for possible inclusion in the E-12 omnibus bill.
Okay. Senator Scogin moves that Senate File 2409, as amended, be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus K-12 education bill. All those and anyone else that wanted to testify? On Senator Scogin's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Hey, we have Senator Latz here. Oh, Senator Pogemiller. Senate File 3763. Welcome, Senator Pogemiller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, it's always a pleasure to be back with Joe Roulette. I think the only three, Joe Roulette, I, and Rose Hermanson, are the only three that have been here longer than, I mean, the rest of you are so young.
Senator Pogemiller, I'm sorry that we don't have our charts behind us. Many of the members here didn't have the opportunity to serve under the former chair of this committee.
I did.
And Senator Olson clearly remembers, but there were multiple charts, I think two or three charts. And the process was, when you brought legislation before the committee, was that the committee had to choose which area that piece of legislation fell into. Kind of, and I can't remember the exact thing, but it was like
A, B, C, D,
but like A was a kind of a for sure thing that it would pass. B, well, maybe or maybe not.
A little work.
Need some work or amendments. C, and as it got down to C and D, it was kind of unlikely that you're, yeah, dream on type possibility.
Well, E was don't ever come back again. With that idea. Don't ever come back with that idea.
Senator Saxon.
Mr. Chair, I don't remember that from the Education Committee, but I do from the Tax Committee. A, B, C. Don't ever come back.
Well, this is an A bill, Mr. Chairman. This is definite A list.
Yes, this is a very simple bill. I'm just looking it over, and I do think I have memories of this one. It goes back a ways. So, Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. Chairman, members, this deals with a technical fix to Senate File 3763, deals with a technical fix to something called Set the Price, which is a report that we've asked school districts to do to tell us basically how much revenue do they need to accomplish the objectives or the outcomes that the legislature has imposed upon them in terms of graduation standards, et cetera. Many of the school districts don't like this because they view it as paperwork, but let me give you a motivation for why this is a good idea to continue this, because it's a way to talk about adequacy and accountability. Asking the service provider that you have a have given the job to deliver outcomes for our children, asking them how much it would do, how much it would cost to do the job you've asked them to do, brings a certain level of accountability. It forces some level of introspection at the district level, but it also puts out in paper and in public what it is someone assumes they need to deliver the outcome you suggested. And so it creates a discussion between the legislature and districts about, are we asking too much out of districts because they don't have enough revenue, or are they asking for more revenue than they really need? Because you can look at what different districts are asking for, what outcomes they're getting, and it creates a accountability discussion that leads to, I think, it leads to a productive thing that most members of the legislature talk about. How much do we have to spend to get the results we want? And that's, it doesn't make any difference if you're Democrat, Republican, conservative, or liberal. Once you see the data, it starts to create a discussion. And my attitude always is if typically when we first started doing this about 5 or 6 years ago, the districts in aggregate came back and said they needed $1 billion more to deliver the standards that we were asking for at the time. It was basically the eighth grade standards. And the discussion was, well, do they need $1 billion or don't they? At least the people we were asking to do the job said they needed $1 billion. So that led me to say, well, is there somebody who can do it cheaper than that? And that's why some of us said, well, maybe we should think about a more market-oriented system here to bring the price down. Others thought that wasn't a good idea and said, no, we should give them $1 billion. Well, we didn't give them $1 billion, but we're still asking for those kinds of outcomes. And so, it forces us all to kind of face reality. And I think it's unfair to ask someone to give you an outcome that you can't get somebody else to deliver for the amount of money you're willing to give them. I just think that's unfair. That's like saying you need to sell me a car for 10 or 20% less than I'm offering, but I can't find anybody else to sell me that car for 10 or 20% less. I mean, that's not the way the real world works. So again, whether you're Democrat, liberal, conservative, Republican, if you think we're putting too much money into the system, then we better find a service provider who can deliver. If you don't think we're putting enough system in the system, then you ought to deliver with the money. And it just, I think it calls everybody, whatever their political philosophy, calls them on the carpet. What this does, this bill says, is because we're changing from simply 8th grade standards to 12th grade standards, we're in the process of doing that in many of the curricular areas. You're all more aware of where we are on that than I am right now. And that job is not done. It's being phased in right now. I sent a letter to Commissioner Segrin about sometime over the summer and said, well, it's probably unfair to ask them to give us a price for something they haven't phased in yet. So let's delay the record keeping for 1 year, or the report for 1 year. And Commissioner Segrin said, yeah, okay, that's a good idea. So what this does is it basically implements that delay and also creates a possibility for some other technical changes to clarify the report. So again, I know districts, many districts, would prefer not to fill this paperwork out. I argue that it's a smart thing for them to fill it out. And I'll use the example that I used in Minneapolis when I was chair, and they said, why do we have to do that? I said, because you come in here every year saying you need a lot more money to deliver for these kids in poverty. How much do you need? And they said, well, it's hard to calculate. And I just said, well, that's not good enough. I mean, you should be able to tell us how much you need to deliver the 8th grade tests. Finally, they went to work, calculated some numbers, and it was interesting to see that their number was not that much different than some other districts around the state were coming up with. And it just forces a little more rigor in the discussion. None of it's perfect science, and no district can fill out the perfect form where they know exactly what it is that it's going to take. But if you aggregate it over the state, it is amazing how there are a lot of correlations around the state, and it helps you think through, I think it helps you think through as a policymaker, what your choices are. Put more money in or find a different service provider. I think I would argue, and I know this will offend both conservatives and liberals, but from a conservative perspective, you tend to argue that there's enough money. Fine. Then come up with a different delivery system. For liberals, you tend to argue that if only we got more money, it would all work out. Well, if we haven't come up with the money, what good is that? And this is an attempt to move people from talking to action and to try to bring some consensus between the different philosophical approaches to education. That's all it is. It's not meant to be a perfect science. There are no great repercussions if you come up with the wrong number in your school district. But it does force you to actually think about the outcomes and the inputs. I just absolutely don't see what's wrong with that from a policymaking perspective. So, but this, all this bill does is say we're not going to collect the report for 1 year because we're phasing in the 12th grade standards.
Okay. Thank you, Senator.
But I'm setting foundation because the districts are always in here trying to kill this. I don't know if they have been this year. Where are they? I think they probably are, but Melcher and I think this is a good idea. At least to look at the numbers, right?
Senator Olson?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was surprised that it wasn't gone, but I see you've been prevailing from afar and hanging on to this for some time.
That's all you're left with after you're out of the chair. All you're left with is hanging on to some modest little things.
No, I think I do agree that I think that information is useful, and especially when we're talking about requirements and then also this year I think we've seen a fairly large increase in the number of new requirements, or I wouldn't say necessarily mandates, but I think we have, at a time when we're very limited financially in terms of what we can do for the districts, it'll be interesting to see what information we get back, you know, if we pass some of the expectations or requirements that we're talking about anyway. So,
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pogonoff?
I'm a liberal progressive, but I think it's absolutely appropriate for ask a school district, how much does this take? And their resistance to that has always kind of bugged me. Because wouldn't you think that'd be in the north natural course of events in running a school district? Kind of thinking through how much money you needed to get it done? But apparently that's, in some districts, has not been the mindset.
Okay, Senator, who had a question? Well, Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just came from hearing the Secretary of Education make a new announcement for a national effort, and I'm not so sure that she wouldn't be somewhat impressed with your approach and philosophy on this, but they essentially, I just give you in a nutshell, that they it's announcing another effort for states to pursue, but efforts that have had a history of reform, are committed to transparency, and also a capacity reform, and also a concern about strengthening accountability to get at all students. We can't afford the slide of struggling students. And she said she's going to continue to stay on the side of the kids. So those are just a few thoughts on this that I think are appropriate to reflect, and in many ways you're saying that the current law, the highest student passage rate the district expects, we ought to be shooting very, very high and looking at what are the things that it's going to take and that we need to do to assure that every student is able to achieve to the very best of their ability and not leave them behind. So, anyway, that's. I don't think this is inconsistent with what she has been talking about, and will be here shortly.
Senator Pogemiller, on your legislation, there was a change in the date from January to August, and that seems to be okay in terms of.
I'd yield to staff on that. They've had discussions with the department and so forth.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogemiller, based on when the data is coming in, we think that this is a better time frame for the department to complete the data. So unfortunately, it means we're going to go through two sessions without data, but I think it's going to be – it'll yield the data in an appropriate time, and then over the interim we can use it.
and then it aligns for legislative policy discussions
right
following here.
Any other? Senator Saxon?
I was just going to move, Mr. Chair, that Senate File 3763 be laid on the table for possible inclusion.
Okay, Senator Saxon moves that Senate File 3763 be recommended to laid on the table and recommended for possible inclusion. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on this? No one? Okay, on Senator Saxhog's motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Always a pleasure.
Yes, thank you very much. And Senator Latz, we have Senate File 1976. Welcome, Senator Latz.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. You have before you Senate File 1976, which is a program is designed to help build developmental assets in children. So much of what we do in Minnesota is targeting at-risk behavior and trying to figure out a way to eliminate the at-risk behavior. Well, the whole paradigm of the Search Institute's approach is just the opposite of that, is to identify assets, positive behaviors, and reinforce those positive behaviors. And the work that they've done, the studies that they've done, have indicated that it is very successful in improving the conduct and reducing the at-risk behavior that is harmful to the communities and setting kids on the healthiest path that is possible. I've seen it work in St. Louis Park. We were the pilot community for the Search Institute in Minnesota. They've been working in our community for 10 or 15 years probably now, closely with the schools, the city, with all sorts of community organizations, the Twin West Chamber of Commerce, the St. Louis Park Business Council. It was a brainchild of the superintendent of the schools at the time and a couple of business people in the community that were looking for something positive that they could do, and it's developed into a whole community-wide program, and it's now, in fact, is national in scope.
Senator Latz,
yes.
Would you like someone to move the delete all amendment?
Yes, please.
Okay. Senator Olson moves that the A1 amendment that I believe everybody has. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Okay. Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The delete all amendment puts the bill in the same form as the House version is in presently. So now the bills match up.
So,
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, some of the healthy communities and healthy youth initiatives that are going on, I'm aware that there's some loss of funding because of some interpretation of a federal regulation or program that is going to make it difficult for some of them to continue, or maybe all of them. I haven't got the precise thing on my brain, but I know I've had a couple conversations over the last year about that. It appears that what you're attempting to do, at least through a grant process, would be available to some. It's not a huge number to be able to continue that work. Are you familiar with what is happening out there, and how yours? I'd be interested in how you see this fitting in with what we have ongoing.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I have with me Nancy Tellett Royce, who's a senior consultant and community liaison for the Search Institute, and she's more familiar with that. I'd ask her to answer the question.
Thank you.
Ms. Royce?
Thank you, and thank you for your question.
Give your name for the record, please.
My name is Nancy Tellett Royce. I'm a senior consultant at Search Institute located in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I have been working with communities for about 10 years around the country, and I think what you're referring to is that a number of them have been using several federal funding streams in order to support their work, whether it's healthy students, healthy schools, or a number of other streams, both through the Department of Education and the Department of Juvenile Justice. And all of those streams have been changing, shifting, and shrinking. So these community initiatives have had to rely on local dollars if they can raise them, or in fact have gone dormant but have still been in contact with us, hoping that they can start up again if they can find the small amounts of funding necessary to keep them alive.
So Mr. Chairman, ma'am, how do you, is the effort here aimed at trying to revive or strengthen some of those that are ongoing, or how do you see the mission of this piece of legislation in relation to what's happening now?
Ms. Royce.
Thank you. Well, I'm here to support this Senate file, and I think I'll just give you my remarks because I think that will answer some of your questions. And I do thank you for allowing me to speak to you this morning. This would launch a statewide effort to spark changes in how Minnesota schools and communities work with young people. While most government programs serving youth utilize a risk reduction approach to serving youth and attempt to prevent certain behaviors, the Senate File 1976 would ensure that schools and communities are empowered to provide the supports and the opportunities that provide life success, rather than trying only to eliminate the factors that lead to failure. As many of you know, the Search Institute is the national pioneer in creating an approach to promoting the healthy development of young people based on a framework of 40 developmental assets, which is grounded in our research. Each of you have been provided with a report entitled Boosting Student Achievement, New Research on the Power of the Developmental Assets. This particular report provides background on the 40 developmental assets and their impact on young people. And our research and research by others has consistently and repeatedly shown that comprehensive asset-based approaches to education and youth development have tremendous potential to contribute to the academic success of students from all backgrounds. And we've seen that happen in St. Louis Park, and I've watched it happen in communities around the country. The best way to build developmental assets in youth is by engaging the whole community and recognizing that all sectors have a role to play in making their communities band together around the assets. And when this happens, academic achievement skyrockets. I've witnessed this in St. Louis Park, both as a mother and as a member of the Executive Committee of Children First, which is an initiative that we have had going there under the Healthy Communities, Healthy Youth banner for about 14 years, and which Senator Latz has been involved with for much of that time. This file would provide $250,000 to Search Institute to support and expand asset-building initiatives throughout Minnesota. These asset-building initiatives are intentional community coalitions. They're often centered around the schools, but include other sectors of the community, ranging from the city government to churches to families to after-school programs and so on. They are designed to support young people in all the places that they live and grow in their communities, using the developmental asset approach as its framework and a unifying language to help people understand they're all on the same page. Senator Ron Latz, the Senate author of this legislation, has been involved in the Healthy Communities, Healthy Youth Initiative in St. Louis Park. Representative Maury Lanning has seen firsthand the power and impact of these efforts in his involvement in the Healthy Communities, Healthy Youth Coalition in Moorhead. And there are many others around the state. Specifically, Search Institute would use the funding through the bill to support the following three activities. We would implement at least 10 new Healthy Communities, Healthy Youth initiatives throughout Minnesota. Search Institute will implement a request for proposal process to solicit proposals from communities interested in launching such initiatives. Select communities, at least one from each of the five geographic regions of Minnesota, would be provided with tools, with trainings, and other resources necessary for the successful implementation of efforts that are focused on their young people and their healthy development, and also strengthening the community. A second activity would be to support at least 8 existing Healthy Communities, Healthy Youth initiatives throughout the state. And through an RFP process, we would select 4 existing Healthy Community, Healthy Youth initiatives to provide additional support. And third, we would strengthen the networking and the information sharing between all Minnesota Healthy Communities, Healthy Youth initiatives, gathering best practices of program success, and sharing these findings among other communities. We would like to create opportunities for bringing these communities together, both in person and through electronic means, for peer learning and ongoing support. I should note that a strength-based approach to student achievement does not require a specific curriculum or program package, but focuses on infusing asset building into existing programs and services that reach youth. It is essential that all the adults in a community, teachers, administrators, janitors, bus drivers, neighbors, parents, coaches, preachers, and state legislators all understand that when they themselves can, what they themselves can be doing to provide the supports and opportunities that young people need to be successful in school and life. There are other states that are moving forward with this type of statewide positive youth development effort. New York State has launched an effort called Assets Coming Together, or ACT, that provides funding to support asset building initiatives in communities across the state. In Maine, the governor has established a children's cabinet that is responsible for monitoring youth attitudes and assets throughout the state and coordinating the government's response. And in California, the State Department of Education mandates that all school districts must be trained in the developmental assets and the importance of relationships in promoting student resiliency. These are just a few of the state initiatives designed to infuse developmental assets into delivery systems that serve youth. Building developmental strengths and skills and assets clearly merits consideration as one of the strategies that school districts and communities can use to positively affect achievement. Senate File 1976 would be a strong first step in ensuring that all schools and communities in Minnesota have access to the resources, the trainings, and technical assistance to help build strong, thriving, and achieving young people. And I thank you for your time.
Hey, thank you, Ms. Royce.
Motion. So you made the motion.
Any questions that members have? The way I understand it is that you'd use this $250,000 for 10 competitive grants. I noticed on line 23 it said throughout Minnesota. Sounds good. Search Institute must also use a competitive grant process to provide 8 existing healthy community and youth initiatives with resources to expand. So how many currently, how many existing programs do you have?
Across the United States, about 600. In the state of Minnesota, we know of about 54.
54. And so there, at the end of this, if this was funded, there would be 64, right?
At least. We would hope some others would decide to jump on board even without this funding.
And is there, I presume there's probably some additional money that's going in besides this?
Most local communities provide some funding on their own through a variety of sources.
Whether it's in-kind or something. Okay. So this wouldn't be just a single source or the total source of funding that's involved in that. Okay. All right. Any other questions that members have? Senator Rummel?
Mr. Chair and members, we have been using the Search Institute instruments and education in our community for a long time, and it has had a very positive effect on the climate of the students in our schools, and I think the tenor of our community, as you know, this last fall when other, you know, was it 99 other school districts went out to pass their levies. We were one of the few that passed, and we passed our levy with a 64% majority. And I think now we've had the Search Institute in our community for over 10 years, and I think the work that we've done with the community in raising awareness and collaborating with our schools and our community in terms of healthy youth has created a climate in our community as a whole that while we only have 1 in 5 families that have children in our schools, we had a 66 or some odd percent support for our levy. Over time, there's this growing understanding of the connection of community to school. And I'd also like to cite the initiative that's starting over at the University of Minnesota School of College and Higher and Human Development. They call it Ready by 21. And again, it's a framework which suggests that instead of dealing with our youth and education in silos, that we come together as whole communities, schools, health delivery systems, community infrastructure in general, parents, that you come together as whole and you look at your children at each part of their developmental stage. And I think that that's the only way that we are going to get the kind of academic achievement everybody seems to say they want. I don't think we can just do it from the inside out in the schools and hammering kids on the head with textbooks. Some of the other initiatives that have come before this table, whether it was the Learning Resource Center that we had last week or whether it was some of the other outside school activities, we need to look at things as a whole. And I think this one really pulls the community and the schools together, and I think it's a very positive thing to do.
Okay. Mr. Chairman?
Senator Lance?
If I might add briefly, there's one other part to the bill, which is to tie in existing programs and get them to communicate better with each other so they can share best practices and strengthen the entire, all the programs in the state through learning from each other's experiences. These dollars are seed dollars. The goal of these dollars is to help generate the kind of community input where eventually when this kind of funding goes away, the community will find it important enough to self-sustain. And that's what's happened in St. Louis Park. The city council, the city puts money into it. The school district puts money in it through the community education programs. The Rotary were the early funders and have been longtime backers of the program. And just a whole variety of different community inputs that all contribute not only their time, their energy. Even the senior volunteer program in St. Louis Park is involved in this stuff. But they contribute their money, too, so that the program self-sustains over time. But some communities, they aren't as familiar with this. They need the seed dollars to get started so they can learn about it and realize how wonderful an opportunity it is.
Okay. All right. Senator Rummel, you want to?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Senate file. What number are we on? 1976 be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus education bill.
One thought on the question I had is on the section two on the appropriation section. The commissioner may expend up to 5% of the appropriation to provide for program evaluation. Was that, do we have a, maybe 25,000? No.
It'd be half that, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, to 5,000, or 12,500. Is that, what's your expectations out of that evaluation?
Mr. Chairman, members, the idea is for the Commissioner of Education to take a good, hard look at the experience of the existing programs and whether this money was well spent, and then can make a recommendation back to the legislature as to whether or not more funds ought to be spent, whether it ought to become a statewide initiative instead of a more targeted, limited initiative. So this will give a chance for some serious academic analytical objective evaluation of the program from the relevant government agency rather than simply relying on the serious analytical and academic and objective analysis from the Search Institute.
Is the evaluation of all of the current programs or just the new programs?
The new programs, Mr. Chairman. But it says this program on line 26 of the amendment, so it's the healthy initiative, healthy community, healthy youth initiative that would be evaluated. But that would include the new programs and the existing programs and the interlocking of those programs as well. So altogether,
so it'd be all the whole program. which would be the 54 current programs and whatever new programs that might.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it probably wouldn't look at all the 54 programs. It would look at the 10 new ones, the 8 expanding ones, and the communication between them. But you can't avoid, in fact, the goal is then to evaluate the effectiveness of the program itself, mm-hmm. Of the Healthy Community, Healthy Youth Initiative program. It's targeting these communities for implementation and review, but that's the program that's being implemented, and it would be the effectiveness of that program that would be evaluated.
All right, on Senator Rummel's motion. Any other questions? Anybody want to testify? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same sign. Motion is prevails. Thank you, Senator Latz.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, members, we have Senator Wieger. Well, you have the policy bill before this committee, and it made it through the state and local.
Yes, Senator Mr. Wieger. Chair, and this afternoon it's before higher ed.
Okay. And so it'll be before us tomorrow. So there's a lot of things in there.
Yes, we received the memo and the heads up.
Okay. So that's it. We'll spend as much time as we need to tomorrow on that. Committee is adjourned.